This podcast is brought to you by the Legatum Institute. I'm Sian Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this lecture. Welcome, everybody, to Legatum Institute. I'm Sian Hansen, the Executive Director here, and we are just delighted to be hosting The Good Right. I should also just quickly say welcome to our global audience online. We have many people joining us, streaming in on the event. For those of you who don't know us, the Legatum Institute is an international think tank, an educational charity. And we want to spread prosperity through free market solutions and through stable democracy. Tim Montgomery, sitting over there, Tim Montgomery is working on a vision for capitalism for our institute, which will deliver the next government, whoever that may be, an agenda to restore faith in the free market system. We at Legatum congratulate this government for working to put its public finances back on track, but also for the efforts of Ian Duncan Smith for getting people into work. And this coalition has also succeeded in making the UK one of the most entrepreneurial countries in the world. The Legatum 2014 Prosperity Index shows that we're eighth in the world. That's a remarkable achievement. And it's thanks to the reforms in education that our guest speaker, Michael Gove, enacted, that children from all walks of life now have the best possible chance to fulfill their academic potential. And now I'd like to hand you over to Tim Montgomery.
Well, thank you all very much for coming this evening. And I hope that you are as excited as I am at the work and the mission of the Good Right. It was said, not I think originally by Churchill, but he did popularise it, that if you're not a socialist at 20, you don't have a heart, and if you're still a socialist by the time you're 40, you don't have a head. Well, I think Conservatives, we've been too ready to accept that you you cede that moral high ground too early on, that we allow people assume that the left has moral superiority. And the mission of the Good Right is to challenge that from the off, to make the case that markets, that civil society, that our beliefs are as morally potent, more morally potent and good for the people at the bottom of society as anything that the left has to offer. I'm in the privileged position of already having read the speech that Michael Gove is about to deliver us. And I can tell you, none of you are going to leave this room disappointed. We've got a really inspiring case for what conservatism represents. And what I would encourage everyone to do when they're not completely fixated by the wisdom we are about to be offered is to tweet a little bit and give attention to those that are fortunate enough not to be with us so that they can gain some of the wisdom from what Michael Gove is saying. And I think most of you have little cards on your chairs, and if you don't have mobile access, there is a Wi-Fi name and Wi-Fi keys. The Wi-Fi password is a little bit complicated, but hopefully that will allow you to have access to the internet and tweet using the hashtag GoodRightLaunch so that we can all see what each other is saying. I'm really grateful to you for coming. I'm incredibly grateful for the Legatum Institute for hosting today. It's been my real privilege to join this organisation. Fascinating. It's the first organisation that I've ever worked in that's women-led and women-dominated. And one day I want to write a piece about all the differences between this women-led organisation and the other organisations I've worked in. It is a good story, but it might have to wait until I have left before I can tell the whole story. But thank you for coming, and thank you, Michael Gove, for being willing to address us tonight.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to be here at the Legatum Institute, and I can say to him that I've spent the last 11 years, more than 11 years, in a woman-led organisation, which has been doing a fantastic job, and that is the Gove family, where Mrs. Gove is undeniably the leader. But I also wanted to pay tribute to the Legatum Institute and the work that it has already done in making the case for free markets and for democracy worldwide. And Cyan and Anne are doing a fantastic job, and I'd like to congratulate them and Christina on everything they've already achieved, which I know is only the beginning. And it's a particular pleasure to be here to help launch The Good Right, an initiative by my good friends, Tim Montgomery and Stephen Shakespeare, which is designed to rebalance the debate about what is best for Britain. Now, Tim and Stephen have identified what they see as a big problem with our politics. They know that the Conservative Party has been a force for social progress over decades, but they fear that it isn't seen that way today. And they worry that that prevents the Conservative Party being in a position to show itself the powerful force for good that they and I know it to be. Now, frankly, I admire what Tim and Stephen are doing. And I've also been struck by the curious vehemence of some of the criticism that they've already faced. For some on the left, the idea of Conservatives asserting our progressive credentials is unacceptable chutzpah. For some on the right, the idea of Conservatives asserting our progressive credentials is indefensible appeasement. But one of the reasons why I support Tim and Stefan as Conservatives in asserting our progressive credentials is because they know that actually it is indispensable to our mission. It is only if we remind people of our commitment to social justice, if we demonstrate our belief in equality of opportunity, and if we affirm that we are warriors for the dispossessed, that we will then be able to win arguments, win elections, and then be in a position genuinely to help the vulnerable and the voiceless. People need to know what's in our hearts before they're prepared to consider our arguments in their heads. And it's vital that we stress our reason for being in politics is to help others, not to implement an ideological blueprint about the size of the state or to defend the interests of the already fortunate. We are in public service to help the people who need us, not just those who agree with us. That's why I welcome Tim and Stefan's emphasis on solidarity and security, as well as enterprise and opportunity. And I know that some will say, well, that's an acceptance of the left's terms of trade. But I disagree. Yes, there are areas where those of us on the right who agree with Tim and Stefan will also agree up to a point with many on the left about government activity. Across many on the right and the left, there is, for example, a commitment to a government-provided social safety net. There's a belief in the justice of government helping the poorest. And there's an attachment to the NHS free at the point of use. But we on the right part company with the left when it comes to a fundamental vision of the aims of the state and the purpose of government action. We believe in the state as emancipator, providing the means by which individuals, families, and the institutions of civil society can grow and flourish. We reject the idea that the state should erode individual independence, usurp the role of families, direct the efforts of wealth creators, conscript civil society, and encourage dependence. And there are any number of political leaders on the right who've instinctively grasped that distinction and who've mobilized the power of government to emancipate. Alexander Hamilton set up a strong central administration for the infant USA, federalizing state debts, establishing a national bank, and supporting, centrally, the development of manufacturing. That laid the foundations for the American Republic's growth and flourishing. His intellectual inheritor was Abraham Lincoln, whose early political career was built on making the case for infrastructure investment, to bind the nation together and to boost economic growth. And of course, it was he who nobly and famously emancipated America's slave population as he secured the Republic's future. In the early 20th century, it was Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican, who reformed capitalism to shift power from corporatists and cartels to consumers and citizens. He knew that the surest guarantee of enduring prosperity was an economic system which, instead of making excuses for the already comfortable, was on the side of the outsiders. Economic policy should foster competition, welcome challenges, and incubate insurgents. And Roosevelt also knew that you needed government, focused, limited, and prudent government, but also active and self-confident government to make markets work. Left to their own devices, capitalists seek out monopoly positions, form cartels, and become rent seekers. So we need government to intervene, as Conservatives did in the UK in the 19th century. In Victorian times, liberalism was the creed of mill owners, manufacturers, and money men. Conservatives sought to balance the liberal emphasis on utilitarian morality and laissez-faire economics with legislation to protect employees, enhance public health, improve workers' housing, and extend the franchise. And that tradition was built on in the decades which followed. Arthur Balfour introduced an Education Act, which dramatically extended state support for schooling and helped emancipate working-class children from the prison house of ignorance. The Baldwin and Chamberlain governments reformed pensions, ran a slum clearance program, and introduced paid holidays for workers. In Churchill's wartime government, it was a conservative, Rab Butler, who extended yet further the reach and liberating power of state education. Harold Macmillan drove through a massive house building program, which dramatically extended home ownership. And in the 1970s and 1980s, when new concentrations of unaccountable power in trades unions and bureaucracies and in corporatist entities such as the CBI contributed to holding Britain and other nations back, strong leaders used the power of government as emancipator more powerfully than ever. Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan sought to rescue capitalism from the corporatists. They fought to extend the ownership of property to millions more, and they brought monopolistic nationalized concerns into the private sector and unleashed enterprise. And they also critically stood implacably resolute against the spirit-destroying and soulless creed of communism, which governed the lives of billions. Because of their determination to defeat, not just to contain communism, the Leninist system buckled and broke. The leadership of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan led to the liberation of billions. And not just from political tyranny, but also from poverty. The collapse of communism, the global spread of free enterprise, and the emergence of new democratic institutions guaranteeing the rule of law and property rights led to the fastest growth in living standards and the greatest extension of opportunity the world has ever known. That is a good that the right secured, and a victory for progress that conservatives won. Now, two decades on, there are new challenges for conservatives, not least because old foes have taken new forms. The irresponsible behavior of unaccountable big banks, combined with the reckless borrowing of unaccountable big government and the weaknesses of unresponsive big bureaucracy, pitched this country into the deepest recession since the war. Hundreds of thousands lost their jobs. Home ownership became an ever more distant prospect for more and more. Citizens who'd saved for decades to secure their retirement found that their fixed incomes were overtaken by rising prices. Opportunity was increasingly restricted to those fortunate enough to be insulated from these shocks by wealth, connections, or educational advantage. It was perhaps an irony. It was certainly a tragedy of just over a decade of Labour government that had ended with unemployment rising, home ownership falling, pensioners being pitched into poverty, and opportunity becoming less equal. And what made all of these problems more difficult to overcome is the effect which globalization undoubtedly has had on developed societies and advanced economies like ours. Globalization has meant that what economists call the return to skills has grown. In other words, the more well-qualified and well-educated any individual is, the more their incomes rise, especially relative to others. And the number of jobs available to unskilled workers has diminished as technology advances and it becomes easier either to move jobs offshore or to automate them. And alongside these trends generating greater inequality, there have also been factors operating under the last government which favored the already wealthy. Restrictions on house building kept prices inflated, benefiting those who already had property to parents. Inadequate regulation and poorly designed tax policies allowed the wealthy and well-connected to protect their property, preserve their incomes, and detach themselves from the economic forces hitting the rest of us. So when this government was formed in 2010, we inherited a Britain which was two nations, an elite insulated from the economic mess that the last government had created, and a majority suffering as a consequence of the mistakes made that led to Labour's Great Recession. And what's driven the government since then has been the determination of ministers to heal that breach, to make opportunity more equal, and to advance social progress. When David Cameron ran for the leadership of my party, he did so, and I supported him, because he defined himself as a modern, compassionate conservative. And throughout the last 5 years, David Cameron has governed, and I've been privileged to support him, as a modern, compassionate conservative. And now David Cameron is campaigning, and I'm proud to support him, to secure a majority for a modern, compassionate conservative government. Because right from the start of David's leadership, we've outlined a vision of government which has been consistent with the principles that Tim and Stefan have outlined, making the state both the guarantor of security and the emancipator of all. David's consistently argued that this country benefits from a secure and well-resourced National Health Service, funded from general taxation and available to all at the point of need. He's made clear that no part of that commitment will ever be diluted. David has insisted that educational opportunity should be extended and inequalities reduced. And he demanded from the beginning that the comprehensive system be modernized to make it work, not overlooked in favor of alternatives. David also liberalised the party's attitude towards development and ensured it was in favour of more house building. And David inaugurated a programme of welfare reform designed to tackle poverty at source. These were all early signals of intent, demonstrating that David understood that in government we'd have to be reformers with a specific mission to make opportunity more equal. And that is what we have done in office. Now, of course, we came to office with the economy a blasted heath and the deficit a deepening chasm. Our first duty was to reduce the deficit and to balance the books, to heal the economy. Now, some have argued that the efforts required to reduce the deficit, the focus on value for money, the search for efficiency in public services, the requirements placed on the public sector to reform, were at best a delay, and at worst a departure from any sort of progressive mission. But I fundamentally disagree. There is nothing compassionate about asking the young to clear up a mess that we couldn't be bothered to tackle ourselves. And there's nothing progressive about stealing from our children. More than that, refusing to deal with a growing deficit means that the amount you have to pay every year just to service your debt grows and grows, dwarfing the amount that you can spend elsewhere. What is progressive about spending more on debt interest than on schools or childcare? What's compassionate about handing over more of our money to financiers than we spend on mental health or child protection? Progressive governments of the centre-left, such as Sweden's and Canada's, and of the centre-right, such as the USA under Eisenhower and Australia under the great John Howard, have always known that balancing the budget, reducing debt, and building up a surplus are investments in our children's future, as important as spending on schools and science. And those countries which entered the Great Recession with surpluses weathered the storm far better than those being profligate. Canada's sound finances enabled not just wise infrastructure investment, but also helped sustain employment and fund sensible welfare provision. Here in Britain, by contrast, after 10 years of Gordon Brown's economic stewardship, we sailed into the storm with a massive deficit. And the result was a catastrophic drop in growth, deeper unemployment, more personal debt, and greater misery for our poorest. Repairing that damage is actually a work of faith in the future. It's the creation of a covenant with our children. It's the expression of a commitment that we will lay the foundations now for the next generation's flourishing. And I believe that's truly progressive. And more than that, the way in which the deficit has been cut has also been driven by progressive instincts. Spending on the National Health Service and schools has been protected. And where spending reductions have been made, in, for example, policing or local government, ministers have used the need for economies to drive greater efficiency, which is why Theresa May has ensured that crime is down and Eric Pickles has ensured that satisfaction with local council services has remained high. And the reductions in public expenditure have been accompanied by tax reform to ensure that the undeserving rich pay more. Under the last government, millionaires from overseas avoided stamp duty and capital gains tax on UK properties. Hedge fund managers used partnership structures to avoid income tax. Banks didn't have to pay a levy on their balance sheets. And in some city firms, bankers were paying less in tax than their cleaners. We've stopped all of that. These and many other tax reforms have brought in billions. As the Chancellor set out in the autumn statement, the richest households will make the biggest contribution to reducing the deficit, both in cash terms and as a proportion of their income. And we expect them to pay more. The Conservative plan for eliminating the deficit in the next Parliament depends on raising another £5 billion from tax reform to reduce tax avoidance. That is not just prudent management, it's progressive politics. And because of the steps that we've taken on tax and spending, the IFS record that income inequality has fallen under this government. That is an achievement in which we should take pride, not overlook or consider incidental. Inequality remains the great social and political challenge of our time, and fighting it is central to our mission in government. As I hope to outline in a moment, the fundamental answer to inequality lies in empowering those who have been failed by the state in the past. But it is also important that as a basic matter of fairness, we ensure that everyone can see that rewards in our society now spring from effort or enterprise, and they are not accumulated by playing corporate games. Restoring the link between reward and effort, emphasizing, as the Prime Minister has so powerfully, that Britain should be a country where what you get out depends on what you put in, is vital for making our whole society work. Adam Smith, the father of free enterprise, was a philosopher before he was an economist. The analyst of The Wealth of Nations was also, and in his mind more importantly, the author of The Theory of Moral Sentiments. If citizens can see the link between actions and consequences in the economic sphere, if endeavour brings success, then the system is seen as fair and markets are seen as moral. But if rewards accrue and benefits accumulate without evidence of effort, then support for our system and faith in free enterprise decline. And one of the central ways in which this government has made explicit the link between effort and reward has been in demonstrating how the sacrifices made to balance the national budget have led to greater individual prosperity. By restoring control to the public finances, showing the world that we've got a grip, that we've been able to keep the cost of borrowing down. That has allowed industry to recover, citizens to stay afloat, and it's given government the freedom to invest in infrastructure. And it was also the essential precondition for the most impressive progressive achievement of this government, getting Britain back to work. The number of new jobs created in the course of the last 5 years has been truly astonishing, a tribute to the enterprise of British industry, the ambition of the British people, and above all, the vision of Ian Duncan Smith. In the last 5 years, Britain's created more jobs than the whole of the entire rest of the European Union put together. Yorkshire has created more jobs than the whole of France. These jobs are predominantly high quality. Three quarters of the rise in employment since 2010 has been in managerial, professional, and associate professional jobs. And these jobs are predominantly full-time. 83% of the rise in employment over the past year is accounted for by full-time jobs. And these jobs are helping thousands escape poverty and dependence. Since 2010, the number of workless households in social housing has fallen by 270,000 to an all-time low. There are 378,000 fewer children now living in workless households, another all-time low. These statistics are impressive, but behind these numbers lies something more important than proof of economic success: individual fulfillment, human flourishing. That is the achievement of Ian Duncan Smith. And also, with that achievement comes greater equality of opportunity. The growth in jobs under this government has not come at the expense of social progress, quite the opposite. More women are in work than ever before. There are now 14.5 million women in work, an increase of 839,000 since May 2010. And more women than men have benefited from cuts in income tax. 58% of those benefiting most from increases in income tax thresholds are women. And the gender pay gap is the lowest on record, a tenth lower than when we came to office. And we've also ensured that work pays for everyone by increasing the minimum wage, increasing the maximum fine on employers who do not pay the minimum wage, from £5,000 to £20,000. And we've also been extending a living wage to more public sector employees and encouraging business to do the same. Because work brings not just an income, but dignity. Not just independence to make your own decisions, but the ability to provide security for those you love. And this point was made very powerfully 2 years ago by the Labour MP, Simon Danchuk, in, of all places, the Daily Mirror. He talked about the profoundly debilitating influence of spending years of your life on welfare, the erosion of dignity, the ebbing of ambition. People achieve things through work, he argued. We create, we fulfill ourselves. We build a home for our family, we set an example. We feel part of a team. We have goals that we can meet or exceed. Work tames nature, brings new beauty into being. Work heals and work inspires. These are work's achievements. But nobody, he argued, achieves things through welfare. Of course we need a generous welfare state to cushion individuals from life's blows, to rescue them from disaster, to ensure that needs are met and lives repaired. But it has to be the purpose of any progressive welfare policy to enable people as quickly and as easily as possible to find work. And that is what Ian Duncan Smith has done. And it's been a moral mission throughout. Ian knows himself what it's like to be unemployed. He knows what cognitive scientists and psychologists have been proving with greater and greater power over the last few years. A life of learned dependency, a life on welfare, is the enemy of happiness and hope. A life of earned success, work and reward, is the surest route to happiness and fulfillment. That's why we want to go further in helping people off welfare and rewarding work by implementing universal credit and cutting taxes from the bottom. And a commitment to getting more young people into satisfying jobs has also driven another hugely powerful but underappreciated set of reforms that this government has introduced alongside Ian's welfare reforms. We've introduced the most radical improvements in vocational and technical education since 1944. Under the last government, vocational education was in a shocking state. Hundreds of thousands of young people, many from the very poorest families, were being directed onto courses and were taking qualifications which gave them no hope of securing the good job that they deserved. As Professor Alison Wolfe pointed out in her groundbreaking review of vocational education in 2011, the staple offer under Labour for between a quarter and a third of those who were in the post-16 group was a diet of low-level vocational qualifications, most of which have little to no labour market value. Among 16 to 19 year olds, at least 350,000 people have got little or no benefit from the post-16 education system. Alison had concluded that Labour had created a system where schools were incentivised to enter students for literally worthless qualifications, simply so those schools could inflate their performance in league tables. And of course, ministers pointed to those league tables and claimed that they were presiding over an intellectual renaissance. But the children that they had lied to about the worth of their studies found that they had spent their time and effort for nothing. That's why we, inspired by Alison's report, set to work to reform and improve vocational and technical education, to give every child a chance. We'd replace Labour's worthless vocational qualifications with rigorous courses, which require the display of real skills to secure a pass. We ended the bias in funding at sixth form, which had favoured academic courses, so vocational courses were fairly funded and work experience incentivised. We reformed apprenticeships so they could not be, as they were under Labour, passed after a few months of whiteboard gazing in an airless classroom. Now, apprenticeships are designed in partnership with business. They last long enough to ensure apprentices can acquire real skills, and passing them depends on demonstrating real competence in those skills in a rigorous way. We've also created new courses and qualifications in computer science, reformed design and technology so it reflected breakthroughs such as 3D printing, and we set up new national colleges which specialise in the skills, from advanced manufacturing to creative and cultural skills, which the economy needs in the next decade. We replaced the last government's alphabet soup with a clear vocational route through school and college. Students now know that they can study tech awards alongside GCSEs, tech certificates alongside AS levels, and tech levels alongside A levels. They can do so confident that these qualifications are now, at last, rigorously assessed and command the respect of employers. I've talked so far about the importance of dealing with the deficit and the importance of getting Britain back to work. And these are, of course, two of the central themes of this general election's Conservative campaign. But actually, our whole campaign is based on illustrating the ways in which our long-term economic plan will make life better for all the people of this country. It's not just by living within our means, generating full employment, and better rewarding work. Also central to this campaign are spreading educational excellence, providing security in retirement, and ensuring more people can own their own home. And underpinning all of those six campaign principles are proposals for the next 5 years. And they are designed to make every stage of every individual's life in Britain more fulfilling, and they're designed to make our society as a whole fairer. Those ambitions, of course, animate our school reforms. And Nikki's proposal to extend those reforms is the third of the pillars of our campaign, after the deficit and supporting Britain getting back to work. It can't be stated often enough that our education reforms have been driven by a moral mission, the need to tackle inequality in our society at its source. And it cannot be said often enough that failing to tackle that inequality hurts us all. It doesn't just diminish each of us as individuals if others in our society live narrowed lives because their potential is unfulfilled. It also holds us back economically, like nothing else. The economic forces which shape our world are, as I mentioned, granting increasing rewards to those individuals and societies which are smarter, better qualified, and always ready to learn. The societies that are investing in intellectual capital, from Singapore to Shanghai and Palo Alto to Poland, are enjoying greater growth. In the past, it was possible economically, even though it was reprehensible morally, to leave a section of society poorly educated. There would always be jobs for hewers of wood and drawers of water, and those jobs could provide for a family. But that is no longer the case in the developed world, and it soon won't be the case anywhere in our world. It's not just the capacity of big business to relocate to where labour costs are lowest. Increasingly sophisticated automation, the world of robotics, drones, and artificial intelligence, is rendering millions of traditional jobs redundant and placing an ever greater premium on high-level skills. Now, we can't avoid or delay these changes, and true progressives would not want to frustrate technological advances which promise so much. The correct progressive response to this change is not to retreat into nostalgia, but to prepare our children for its opportunities, all our children. And that is why this government has raised the level of expectation in all our schools. It's not enough just to stretch the academically most gifted. We've raised the bar for everyone and closed the gap, because it was both ethically indefensible and economically self-harming to have an education system which left so many behind. Under Labour, more boys from Eton made it to Oxbridge than all of the 80,000 children on free school meals, the children from our poorest homes, put together. The top five schools in the country, four of them private, sent more of their young people to Oxbridge than 2,000 other state schools combined. After 13 years of labour, students in private schools were four times as likely to get three A's at A level as their peers in comprehensive schools. But now, thanks to this government, there are new schools, academies and free schools, based in our poorest neighbourhoods, which are sending more children to top universities than some of our most famous private schools. The academies programme has ensured that the country's best head teachers have been given responsibility for our most challenging schools. The free schools programme has meant that some of the best primary schools in this country have been set up in just the last few years, and in some of our toughest areas. Alongside these new schools, a new curriculum that sets high standards for all, and the investment of more than £2.5 billion in the pupil premium have helped raise achievement for all children. That's a progressive achievement of which we can all be proud. And alongside building on education reforms, our campaign also stresses the need to extend our housing reforms. Building tens of thousands more starter homes, offering discounts to first-time buyers by reducing the red tape which drives up building costs, making it easier for people to get a deposit through Help to Buy, ensuring councils make land available for artisan builders to invest in smaller developments, overhauling the planning system, and letting offices and other underused buildings become houses. All of these changes have helped fulfil a central Conservative mission, helping people to own their own home. Extending property ownership isn't just a good in itself, it also enhances the quality of millions of lives. The security of home ownership makes it easier to start and to raise a family. Nothing generates greater happiness and fulfilment in our lives than healthy relationships. And nothing helps cement those relationships more than a place that each family can call its own. Owning the right home is an investment in a better future. It means children able to do their homework in peace. Sons and daughters learning about the responsibilities of the future in a warm and loving environment. It also means the next generation enjoying the prospect of long-term financial security. The whole history of human progress has been marked by the move from communal living to family living, from uncertainty over tenure to the security of ownership, from the concentration of property in the hands of a few to property that each can call their own. And that is why I think that the drive for greater home ownership that David Cameron has led in our campaign is a quintessentially progressive cause, as is our commitment to safeguard and secure the position of our older citizens. Low interest rates have helped our economy grow, but they have also held down the incomes of millions who have worked hard, saved, and simply wanted dignity in retirement. Under Labour, the link between effort and reward, indeed between thrift and security in our pension system, was broken. Gordon Brown's policies meant, in Frank Field's words, that the country in Europe, which at the start of the last Labour government had one of the best pension systems in Europe, found itself at the end of that government with one of the worst. And repairing that damage, giving older people the security of a triple lock on their pension, incentivizing saving once more, and giving pensioners greater control of those savings, all help right a social injustice. And we should not be shy of saying that those whose taxes and national insurance payments were squandered by the last government should not now be left out in the cold. And that is why the sixth pillar of our campaign is making sure that people enjoy dignity in retirement and security in retirement. Now, the longer and more fulfilled lives which so many of our citizens can now expect is a victory for progress. But it does bring with it challenges, not least ensuring that the quality of social care, hospital treatment and support for those living with dementia is assured. And it has been striking how Jeremy Hunt and David Cameron have made the quality of personal care, the direct relationship between professional and patient, friend and victim, the defining feature of our approach towards health. Part of this has, of course, been in response to tragedies like Mid-Staffordshire. But part of it also has been that both David and Jeremy understand the importance of personal agency and personal responsibility in ensuring that others flourish. If you subcontract caring to the system, if you make health simply a matter of outcomes, if you regard dementia as a friend's departure from our world rather than an opportunity to bring them closer to your heart, then you miss the essence of compassion, because it springs from the desire to help another because you feel that you ought, rather than being told that you must. And in David and Jeremy's response to the challenges that the health service faces, you see what modern compassionate conservatism means. Modern, because it's aware that we face new pressures as the result of economic and demographic changes. Compassionate, because it recognizes that means that we need a greater emphasis on care and relationships. And conservative, because the role of individual agency and personal responsibility is at the heart of making things better. And I've seen this government apply those same principles and instincts to other issues that I care about deeply. This government's reformed social work because one of the greatest scandals in modern Britain is the abuse and neglect still suffered by thousands of children. Abuse and neglect that scars lives forever and often lies behind the complex tragedies of child sexual exploitation, lifelong drug abuse, and crime. We've recognized that we have to ensure social workers are empowered to be firmer with adults so we can better protect children. There's been a Conservative insistence on parental obligations and responsibilities, which we believe is the most compassionate approach for children. And if parents cannot protect their children, or worse, if they acquiesce in or connive at their abuse, then those children have to be rescued, which is also why we've made adoption easier, have invested in more support for adoptive parents, and have spent more on the education of children and care, and why we're reforming the circumstances under which they leave care. We can see that both the condition of our National Health Service and our child protection system have come under scrutiny this month, with stories in the newspapers that are difficult to read to the end and impossible to explain to our children. But the fact that in both areas, it has been ministers who've been driving the changes, which we hope will save lives in the future, which should remind us that a progressive Conservative government can be a powerful force for good. And therefore, the government that we choose matters. And in just over 50 days, this country will choose. And I hope it chooses progress. Because I fear that if David Cameron is not Prime Minister, the progress that we've made in the last 5 years will be lost. It's not just that the education reforms which have helped liberate hundreds of thousands of children, or the welfare reforms which have helped create almost 2 million jobs, might be set aside and then reversed. It's not only that the ministers who've been driving increased home ownership, pension reform, improvements in health and social care, and reform of child protection will be stopped in their tracks. It is also crucially that the economic recovery, which powers and pays for progressive reform, will be placed in danger. I don't mean to demean individual Labour politicians that I admire or doubt the good intentions of most of their front bench. But their economic policy, such as it is, involves more borrowing, more taxing, and more spending, and thus risks destroying the global confidence that we at last got a grip on our public finances. And it's not even as if the extra spending that Labour hopes to be able to make is directed squarely at reducing inequality and advancing social progress. Take the party's proposals for higher education, which will mean that student fee repayments are cut for the wealthy without anything being done to tackle educational disadvantage in our schools. It's a subsidy for those who already enjoy good fortune, with a chance foregone to transform the lives of the less fortunate. What is worse, the electoral arithmetic and Labour's weakness in Scotland make the chance of a Labour majority government increasingly remote, and that raises the risk of Miliband seeking an alliance with the Scottish Nationalist Party to break into power. And if anything, it has to be said the SNP is even less progressive than Labour. Their commitment to much higher borrowing places even bigger debts on our children's shoulders. An SNP education policy, as actually the best Labour voices have pointed out, has nothing to offer children trapped in failing schools, but still guarantees free higher education for the children of millionaires. And as we all know, the campaign pitch of the Scottish Nationalists in this election is a demand for as much money as possible to be invested not in the poorest, not in those most in need, not in the most vulnerable, wherever they live in these islands. Money has to be directed to Alex Salmond's pork barrel. That's why, in the weeks ahead, I will be doing everything that I can to remind people of the good that this right of centre government has achieved, the progress we've made, the opportunities we've extended. And I know that I and my colleagues will also be laying out, in the weeks to come, how much more can be achieved to secure our future, to make opportunity more equal, and to ensure that Britain is the fairest, most progressive, and most successful nation in the world. Thank you very much.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.